And welcome back to the Liberty Librarian. This is your host, Heather Biederman. It's nice to have you back here this week on this beautiful Monday evening, early evening, late afternoon, depending on where you live. This week has been kind of, once again, a little bit crazy, but good. I'm getting costume fever because in a couple weeks, Labor Day weekend is coming up, and one of our favorite events ever, Dragon Con, is coming up. So, of course, the Flight of the Bumblebees is myself and my friends who are attending are making costumes like crazy people. The one that's causing me the most headaches right now is the Sansa Stark from Game of Thrones costume that I'm going to be doing. I'm really excited about it. So hopefully, knock on wood, all this painting that I've been doing will be coming to an end soon. And yeah, I'll post some pictures on the Liberty Librarian page so you can see what a real queen looks like, right? So other than that, it's been, everything is kind of hurtling towards back to school time. And if you have kids, I mean, I know you've seen the stuff in the stores. If you're a student, you're seeing it, and there are all your supplies are at the stores like, you know, your Targets or Walmarts, you know, so you can't hide from it, right? It's really terrifying for students, I'm sure. And you know, as a faculty person, I both get really excited about it, but I get nervous too, because then you think about all the things that you still got to get done before to prep, to get ready, and there's a lot to do. But you know, there's also part of me that's loving summer and enjoying the relaxation and spending more time with my cats and doing stuff around the house. So I'll kind of miss that too. So if you're going back to school, shoot me a note. Let me know what you're doing, you know? Oh, so I think that one of the things that I'm really excited about is getting back into that, and I've just started a new group. I think I told you guys about it before. It's the Intellectual Freedom Committee. It's with the Office of Intellectual Freedom at the American Library Association. I'm on the Publications Committee, so I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to be helping out with that and seeing if there's anything exciting that we can do with that. So before I get too much into it, I have a lot of news to cover today and some interesting stuff. We're going to talk a little bit about, there's a new movie in the theaters called Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. And if you were a kid in the 90s, you probably remember the books. They were banned at a lot of schools, and a lot of public libraries banned them. And now they've made a movie, finally, a movie about them. And people have mixed feelings about it. So I just want to talk a little bit about that later today, too. So before I get going, I'm going to play a few ads to pay some bills. And I see there's a caller on the line. So I'm going to mute this while I play some ads and then check in with you. Okay? So hold on. Let's see.
I like the way you grow it, no pesticides. I got to box it up.
Box it up, yeah.
I like the way you grow it, so locally. I got to box it up. I like the way you grow it, with no GMOs. I like the way you twerk it,
no diggity,
no doubt.
We've got squash and peas, pollinator packs for all your bees. Melons you wanna squeeze. Yes, please. Yes, please.
Hey, now that plant looks good.
I wanna grow it. I wanna taste it.
You're my kind of girl.
You know the Constitution like the back of your hand. You've read books, listened to podcasts, attended lectures, surfed websites, and watched videos. You've made liberty your life's goal, but something seems to be missing. Stickers from LibertyStickers.com. Exercise your freedom of speech with the world's most dangerous bumper stickers. That's LibertyStickers.com. But wait, there's more. You can buy Liberty stickers wholesale. Get them for 99 cents each when you put 100 or more in your shopping cart in any combination. Sell them or give them away. They're great for gun shows, flea markets, fairs, outreach, and more. Earn extra money, promote freedom, and spread the word. Need custom stickers, labels, or decals for your organization or business? Liberty Stickers makes them. Go to LibertyStickers.com to order or call 877-873-9626. LibertyStickers.com, the world's most dangerous stickers.
And welcome back to Liberty Librarian. I'm going to see who's on hold and see if they want to talk. And if it's not going to work out, then we will go right into the news. Hi, this is Heather. Anybody there? Nope. Okay. So, dumping them. They might have just walked away, but it looks like someone tried to call in, and I don't have that happen very often. So, if you ever want to talk, you can call in too. So, today in the news, and I will just, like I always say, a lot of the news that I get is from the web, but I get a lot of it from the Intellectual Freedom blog. The Intellectual Freedom News from the Office of Intellectual Freedom of the American Library Association has great news. And if you ever want to know more, or you can't get enough, and the highlights I share with you during the week, there's tons more than I could ever cover, even like if I just did the news pretty much all morning or all afternoon, you know. So go and check out that page. It has the actual links to the articles that I usually talk about, but also more. And every Friday they put a new one up. So this is what I cover on our little talks this week. So first in the news, I should have some sort of music, don't you think? Like that's like the news. So that's something to think about for next time. We'll play. In the news today in Wired Magazine, they talk on August 7th that Elizabeth Warren unveils a plan to expand broadband access. So the senator and presidential candidate wants to offer $85 billion in grants to nonprofits and municipalities to bring the internet to underserved areas. And you remember last week we talked a little bit about the census that's coming up. And the census, they're relying a lot more on doing sending it out electronically and having less people actually go door to door to take the census, right? So this is one of the things that might actually be able to address some of that problem is by having underserved areas get more internet. But $85 billion, where's that money coming from, right? So, and it says that despite decades of work by government agencies and nonprofits, the digital divide remains wide. So about 26% of Americans in rural areas have no access to home broadband internet, according to a report released by the FCC last May. But broadband is probably even scarcer in rural areas, as the report suggests. The FCC is traditionally considered an entire census block, which can include hundreds or thousands of people to be served by a broadband provider if the provider offers service to a single home on the block. So it could cost thousands of dollars for a customer to connect, but everyone else may not have that. So the agency only changed its reporting requirements this current month. So when the broadband is available, many people can't afford it. So the Pew Research Center report said 19% of people who don't use the internet cited the cost of internet service or the expense of owning a computer as the reason they weren't online. So Elizabeth Warren, the presidential candidate and senator from Massachusetts, Democrat, unveiled a plan to spend $85 billion to bring internet service to unserved and underserved areas, along with proposals to restore net neutrality and crack down on what she calls sneaky maneuvers, quotes, unquote, by broadband providers to increase prices and decrease competition. She wants to make sure that everyone in America has a fiber broadband connection at a price that families can afford. So they're making the internet, having broadband, almost a right for everyone in the country. And it's also detailed that other proposals are being brought to the table to invest in rural America. So Warren is among the first presidential candidates to inject telecom policy into the campaign. She has issued unusually detailed proposals on other topics, including a plan to break up big tech companies under antitrust laws. So, you know, you kind of wonder what's going to happen. Is she going to have actually, are they going to go out after her? Will she even make it as a presidential candidate if she's attacking these huge companies? We will see. So she calls her plan a public option for internet, but she doesn't propose that the federal government deliver internet access itself. She instead wants to provide grants to broadband providers to connect underserved areas. So I feel like there's kind of sneakiness to this too. I mean, you're giving money to the provider. So what does she get back out of it? It makes the little bells in my head go off. I mean, it's a great idea to have everyone have internet and to be able to connect, but I mean, what are they going to do about people who don't have computers, right? So Warren isn't satisfied with the results of the programs such as Connect America Fund and the Universal Service Fund that also provide grants to internet providers to offer service in underserved areas. So it's already being done, but she wants more. She wants more money, and she also wants money to go to nonprofit corporations. And she says to only do the minimum required to receive the funds. So Warren said that she would include such companies from her grants, which like nonprofits, and it would be limited to electricity and telephone cooperatives, nonprofit organizations, tribes, cities, and counties. So a lot of small towns have already built their own publicly owned networks. So would these funds go to them? It seems like that would be what she's aiming for. So if communities are already taking it on themselves, it's sort of a back end paying them for the work that they are doing. So that seems like it's helpful. Once again, where does this money come from? And she proposes creating an Office of Broadband Access, OBA, with a Department of Economic Development to run the program. And she said they would set aside $5 billion of the $85 billion specifically for tribal nations and expand the FCC's Office of Native Affairs and Policy to provide additional training and funding. So she wants to make broadband market more competitive. And the libertarian part of me worries that all this huge billions of dollars going into and controlling broadband, where is the potential? There is a potential for abuse, mismanagement. So I worry about how they're going to prevent that. So hopefully in the partisan politics of it, there is some checks and balances for that as well, which I don't see. As for the net neutrality, Warren says that she will appoint FCC commissioners who will restore the Obama-era regulations banning broadband providers from blocking or otherwise discriminating against lawful content on their networks. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. Okay. I think that these Obama-era regulations banning broadband providers from blocking or otherwise discriminating against lawful content on their networks it's, I'm wondering how they're going to do that. But the current Republican-controlled FCC has floated similar ideas. And I don't know if she's trying to make this a big thing for her presidential run, or if it's actually going to be helpful, or it's going to get dropped. But at this point, I've heard talk about Internet for All, and I've heard about Education for All, especially Bernie Sanders has been out talking. I think I saw him on Joe Rogan. And it's all of these projects sound really great. I mean, I'd love it if everybody had the chance to go to school if they wanted to, for everyone to have Internet. But these are billions and billions of dollars. And where is this money going to come from? I mean, our whole country is over our eyeballs in debt. And I'm not sure how they're going to turn it around if they have these huge proposals that sound really good on paper, but are they going to be good in practice? So something to think about, Elizabeth Warren. Okay, onward. This is a real short piece. You know, the last week or so, they had the El Paso, 2 weeks ago, El Paso had a shooter, right? We talked last week about not giving power to terrorists, not giving power to shooters and people who do terrible things like that, taking the power away. This is sort of related in that when the shooter was getting ready in the parking lot, he posted an anti-immigrant manifesto on what's called 8chan, which is an internet forum service. So it's in being discussed by politicians, and it was taken down. I'm going to talk a little bit about it. So it's about the limits of free speech on the internet. So there's urgency to the question, according to people who run everything. The suspect posted this manifesto on against Hispanic immigrants on 8chan. After the shooting, 8chan lost the support of a crucial network services company. So they took away their support for it because they were looking bad for providing service to 8chan. But because of that, it has taken away free speech on the internet. And NPR's Martin Kaste reports on a debate over the policing the internet speech. So this was on August 6th, and I found this article on NPR by Martin Kaste. So the host, Ari Shapiro, said, "Who gets to decide the limits of free speech on the internet?" After the shooting, they lost their support. And according to Martin Kaste, curbing online hatred is a thorny problem in the country with America's strong free speech tradition. Here's Democratic presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren, once again, being put on the spot on CNN just one day after the tragedy. And they gave a sound bite. Should these sites be shut down, Senator? And Elizabeth Warren said, "Look, this is one where I'm very nervous about government intervention in this area, and yet we have to be thinking about public safety here." And they left it policing free speech to companies. This is from Kaste again. And at first that suited the tech world with its libertarian leanings. So this is news to me that the tech world is libertarian. So I'm kind of glad to hear that. So Twitter, for instance, used to call itself free speech wing of the free speech party, but there's been a reckoning because people love free speech until it's something they don't want to hear. So I think everyone's getting smart to the fact that, you know, the internet is now all rainbows and unicorns. Well, duh. So they say there's pressure on internet companies to take responsibility for what others publish, even companies that just provide network services. So sites like 8chan depend on companies that can handle big surges in demand and can also fend off attacks from hostile attackers. So there's only a handful of those that can handle something like that for a huge site like 8chan. They say that something like Cloudflare or Akami, have other hosting platform sites can mitigate attacks. So they had relied on the company called Cloudflare, but they got dropped after the shooting. 8chan had trouble finding a replacement because, I mean, it's so huge. But Cloudflare didn't sound happy about the situation. Their CEO, Matthew Prince, quoted, "We continue to feel incredibly uncomfortable about playing the role of content arbiter and do not plan to exercise it often." Unquote. The household names of the internet are more used to this role of speech police. Facebook and YouTube are just too visible to the public to sidestep the responsibility. So there's content moderation. Etsy decides every day whether or not it's going to let people sell Nazi paraphernalia, according to this Kate Klonick. Airbnb has people post art in their homes and they can put it on the internet. It's free speech, right? There's not a right answer, though. Some conservatives say the enforced norms are trending liberal. So they say that there should be impartiality of the social media platforms. But leftists have been tripped up by changing norms, too. In case of the Canadian feminist writer Megan Murphy, last year she was booted from Twitter, apparently because she refuses to refer to transgender women as women. So if you have an unpopular viewpoint, it's very likely that you will lose your service. You will get booted. You will get banned. And is this the way that we should be handling these things? I tend to disagree with that. It's very slippery slope where we start going down that path of blocking content, really. And it's an easy thing to do just to say, like, oh, we don't have a service provider because it's too, they disagree with it. Well, I almost wonder if they need to make their own kind of contracts with the service provider, someplace like 8chan or Twitter, that talks about the fact that they need to make it more difficult to cut content. Sorry, cat issue. Always wants to be in the way. So anyway, they talk about the discomfort in the role of speech police. Ideas like this may catch on. So companies think that they can offload some of the responsibility. Facebook, it says, is planning a new panel of independent outsiders to review its content moderation, something that tech media have already dubbed Facebook Supreme Court. So we are on the edge of a dark time where censorship is going to be the norm. And even stuff like this where I'm talking about it, who knows how much longer we'll be able to have content where we can just talk freely like this. It may go away. So let's all cherish the free speech we have right now because it could be gone. Okay, switching gears. This week, it's more sad news. And beloved, the author, Toni Morrison, has died at 88 last week. It's really sad news. As a librarian, we have a ton of her books in our library, and we're putting up a display in her honor. But she died last Monday night, according to her publisher. She was 88 years old. And died peacefully after a short illness. She was originally born Chloe Ardella Wofford. So Toni Morrison was best known for her critically acclaimed and best-selling novel, Beloved, which won the 1988 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. And she had other memorable and influential novels like Jazz in 1992, Paradise in 1997. And the three books make up kind of a loose trilogy. Just after the last of them was published, Morrison was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature, becoming the first Black woman of any nationality to do so. and the Nobel Prize Committee celebrated her as an author who, in novels characterized by visionary force and poetic import, gives life to an essential aspect of American reality. So she, at that point, when she won the Nobel Prize, she had already written 6 novels, and she would go on to write 5 more. Her latest book was called God Help the Child in 2015. She wrote through the toughest of times, including the death of her own son in 2010. And she stopped, I stopped writing until I began to think he would be really put out if he thought that he had caused me to stop, Morrison told Interview Magazine around the release of her 9th novel, Home, in 2012. And then before she was a world-renowned author, Morrison broke barriers as an editor for Random House, where she worked for 19 years, publishing a new generation of Black writers, including Toni Cade Bambara, Gail Jones, and Angela Davis. She was also the chair of humanities at Princeton, where she taught from 1989 to 2006. She said, "We die," Morrison closed her Nobel Prize address. "That may be the meaning to life, but we do language. That may be the measure of our lives." So goodbye to you, Toni Morrison. Your books are loved and you will be remembered. You know, when I think about great authors like Toni Morrison and sometimes pushing boundaries, getting into areas where we talk about things like rape and feminism and ideas and concepts that people are uncomfortable with. We need to have uncomfortable topics written about. We need to have all sorts of viewpoints. We need to have books on LGBTQ. We need to have opposing viewpoints in libraries. And I think that especially when you get such great writers, it's our moral imperative to really show representation. So when I read this in Iowa Public Radio, All Things Considered, they said Northwest Iowa man was ordered to pay a fine for burning LGBTQ library books. So this was written by Katie Peaks, August 6th. So this man named Paul Dorr was fined $65 and a 35% surcharge for burning 4 LGBTQ-themed children's books from Orange County Library last year. So he burned them, and he was found guilty of fifth-degree criminal mischief. Now, this Paul Dorr, who's 63, I can see if I say this right, Ochedeian, Iowa, runs a Christian group called Rescue the Perishing. It was fine. $65 is not much, considering you're a book burner. I'd almost think you'd be banned for life from being in a library. But the $65 fine is a minimum for his charge, a simple misdemeanor. So the Sioux County attorney, Thomas Kunstel, represented the state of Iowa, requested Dorr be fined the maximum penalty of $625 for destroying the library's property. So in October 2018, last year, this Dorr recorded himself on a video posted to social media publicly burning 4 children's library books that have lesbian, gay, and bisexual themes, mostly in protest for a pride festival happening in Orange City. So according to the criminal complaint filed by Dwayne Holstein, an investigator from the Orange City Police Department, this person, Dorr, checked out these 4 books from the public library on October 6th. Then he burned them, damaging them beyond use on October 19th. Dorr on Tuesday defended himself in court and chose not to testify during his non-jury trial. Before his sentence, Dorr recited the last 2 stanzas of the Netherlands national anthem in English, the alma mater of Orange City's Northwestern College. That's a really weird thing to do. Doar declined to comment to the media immediately after the trial. In a written statement, he said he burned the books to exercise his freedom of speech and faith. This is what he said. My motive was to honor the triune God in whom my faith resides and to protect the children of Orange City from being seduced into a life of sin and misery, Doar said in his statement. The statewide LGBTQ organization, One Iowa's interim executive director, Courtney Reyes, condemned Doar's actions in a statement. This is her statement. Libraries are safe havens where every person has free access to all ideas and expressions without restriction. Doar intended to deprive the children of Orange City that access, to isolate LGBTQ youth from the reflections of themselves and stories, to take from all youth the opportunity to empathize with people different than themselves. Such an act is terrible, and we are glad justice was served today. So the ACLU of Iowa, which advocates to protect free speech, called Doar's actions disturbing. And it says burning books from a public library is an attempt to shut down the open sharing of discussion and ideas. I'll pause right there. I totally agree with that. You have a right to disagree. You have a right to protest. You have a right to send letters to a library asking them to remove it. And they will listen to your letters. They take them very seriously. They may not choose to do it, but you have those your free speech rights. Now, when you're destroying property, you're committing crimes to prevent people from reading, to prevent people from discussing something, you are stopping free speech, really. That's what you're doing. So I agree with that sentiment. So burning public books, this is what they said. Burning public books is a destruction of ideas, and that's reprehensible. Bettis Austin said, the destruction of books from a public library is a clear attempt to shut down the open sharing and discussing of ideas. No one person or even group should decide they are the gatekeepers of ideas for the rest of the public. So in this trial, they talk about the witnesses, the chief investigator, and a public library employee named Cheryl Kugler from Orange City Public Library. She testified that Doar came to the library, applied for a library card in October. So he specifically came there because I think he just wanted to check out the books to burn. He wasn't already a patron of the library, which makes me think that he's not much of a reader. So he wanted the library card, he told her, because his mother-in-law would be entering a care facility in the area, and he wanted her to become more familiar with her library, since he would be there more often. Kugler said she informed him of the library's checkout policies before giving him a library card. In the weeks after the Doar's video went viral, the library received an outpouring of support in the form of donated books and money. Kugler said the library received between 800 to 1,000 book donations, over $3,700. So the loads of books included copies of the four books, Doar burned, and other titles. So if his intent was to stop the children in that community from reading those kind of books, it backfired severely. So you can see a better option for him would have been to write letters, to ask them to ban a book, to ask them to do things legally. Doing things illegally often leads to this kind of thing. So I'm not sympathizing with him. I'm just saying if you are entitled to your own ideas, you can disagree. You can. That's why we live in America. It's a free country. But you start using criminal activities to push your point, you're gonna have it backfire. It's just the way it is. Use your brain. Try to do better things to help people. But I was glad to see that even though he did these terrible things, getting about 1,000 book donations and all the books back, that worked out pretty good for the library. So the library entered fewer than 50 into its collection. The rest were sent to be resold or returned to vendors. So people love libraries, and I'm really glad to know that. It's sad that somebody would be be basically a book burner. I really don't want to live in a world where there's book burning and there's censorship and your privacy is taken away at every moment. It breaks my heart. So hopefully we don't see too many of those kind of small-minded weird things happening, but I just wanted to share that it happened in Iowa and not too far from here where I live. So it can happen anywhere. Okay. International news of the weird. Speaking of book burning, Turkey, the country, burns 300,000 books from schools and public libraries. This was last updated on August 8th. On the ZMEScience.com website. So it said that 300,000 books from Turkish schools and libraries have been destroyed since 2016. The Turkish Ministry of Education has announced this. Turkish officials claim the books are linked to Fethullah Gulen, the Muslim cleric, with the current regime considers to be responsible for the 2016 Turkish coup d'etat attempt. However, critics say that burning books goes way beyond that. So, if you, like we talked about in the last article I shared with you, destroying books is rarely a sign of a healthy democracy. Yet, with seeming pride, Turkey's education minister, Zaya Sulukuk, announced last week that 301,878 books had been destroyed. It's part of a government crackdown on anything linked to this. Gulen is regarded as an enemy by Erdogan's party, charged with multiple crimes against the state, although the evidence is not compelling. So because of this, burning these books happened in like the last 3-4 years. So there's a popular newspaper called Hürriyet, which raised some important questions about this decision to burn the books, such as if the books are indeed subversive, and then why did they end up in the schools in the first place? This is also confirmed with images of books being seized and burned, published by the online news outlet Kronos 27, which seems to be bouncing online and offline for unknown reasons, so it's targeted. So a situation was also analyzed by a website called Turkey Purge, which describes itself as a small group of young journalists who are trying to be the voice for the Turkish people who suffer under an oppressive regime. They report that a 2016 mathematics book was banned because a question read from point F to point G, these being the initials of Fethullah Gulen. So they said that because there was F and G in there, they had to burn the book, which is crazy and ridiculous that a math book is burnt. So a similar situation was described in December 2016 by the Turkish newspaper Bir Gün, which reported that 1.8 million textbooks had been destroyed and reprinted for containing the word Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, which is where Gulen lives in a guarded compound. That I did not know. It's hard to justify these actions under reasonable attempts to reduce a harmful influence. So they're making the decisions to burn the books, not because they're having content that can damage young minds, because they have words that may lead them to think about, you know, where this past leader had gone to. That's freaking ridiculous. So free speech organizations have spoken out against these efforts. PEN, International, Penn International, Worldwide Association of Writers, founded in London in 1921 to promote literature and intellectual cooperation, says that the publishing landscape in Turkey has been decimated, with over a quarter of all publishing houses being shut down for spreading terrorist propaganda. This reminds me so much of The Handmaid's Tale. It's really creeping me out. In that show, the main character worked for a newspaper, and all the newspapers, they pretty much took everyone into like other rooms and killed them if they didn't already make them leave, shut everything down. So it got worse and worse. So they take your news out, they take out all your sources of information, and then you only have them. And that's where it's all going. So anyway, they say this, after a state of emergency was decreed after the attempted coup, over 200 media outlets and publishers were shut down, and almost 6,000 academics have been dismissed from 118 public universities. They go after the academics. Turkey is undergoing a crisis, and there are reasons to believe the current government is using the attempted coup as an excuse to crack down on intellectual freedom and freedom of speech. Here's a quote. The government has dramatically increased its influence on the media and publishing landscape, thereby silencing critical voices, said Penn. We call on the Turkish authorities to permit the reopening of an independent operation of publishing houses and urgently end their far-reaching crackdown on freedom of expression, which continues unabated. So, if you had any doubts that Turkey was going through a terrible, terrible time, it's true. It's very true. I would read up more on it. It's seems to me that they're using this, the attempted coup is just a device to silence people, to get rid of anyone who would oppose them, under the guise that they're trying to get terrorist ideas. Does that sound familiar? Yes, it should, because they do that in our country too, by taking away ideas and freedom of speech. There is no discussion. There is no free speech and discourse. We need to have books. We need to have news. We need to have video and websites and, you know, television news. We need to have these resources, and they need to be independent. They need to be separate from any government that's in charge, because they need to be questioned. And in most governments, our government, we have a lot of checks and balances, so things work out. But unchecked, things can go terribly wrong. So just use Turkey as an example of how things can go terribly wrong, and that it can get worse and worse for any of us. Okay, let's see. I think that's the last of the news I wanted to cover. Yeah, they talked a little bit about FBI and student surveillance. I'm not going to have time to go into all of that, but I love to share the news with you. And I'm kind of sad there wasn't any exciting technology news. It's usually my favorite ones, but it's a slow week for that. I'm kind of glad. Slow week means they're not taking your rights away. That's kind of awesome. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play a couple ads, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about scary stories to tell in the dark, and about banned books and how over time they can become more and more accepted, and what's changed in our society that made it happen. So I will be right back. See you in a little bit.
Want to live a happy and healthy barefoot lifestyle? Join Barefoot is Legal, Saturdays, 1:30 p.m. Eastern, 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time, to learn your rights to be barefoot. There are no laws against bare feet in public, and we are here to dispel the myths and empower you to stand up for your rights. Join full-time barefooters and victim legal advocates Nick Pierce and Richard Johnson on Freedomizer Radio for the Barefoot is Legal Show, Saturdays, 1:30 p.m. Eastern, 10:30 a.m. Pacific, and check out our website at barefootislegal.org.
Hello, Freedomizers. Joanne Moretti here. Join me and my co-host Scott Ferrarello and crew every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for the latest news, politics, current events, investigative reports, right here at freedomizerradio.com. See you on Wednesday at 6 Eastern.
And welcome back to Liberty Librarian. Today, I'm going to talk a little bit about banned books. And I know it's aging myself, but back in the early 90s, there was a series. So think about that. Like, we're getting to be about, is it 30 years of, or is it 40? I'm trying to remember. But so Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark was banned book. And it, now it's in a major motion picture. It's available now in the movie theaters. I looked on the website and I see that it's in my own town. So I'm sure it's almost everywhere. It's in small town Minnesota. You can, if you've read these, you'll remember them. They have a cover of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. It had a cover image of a head resembling a clown skull, which is freaky. I hate clowns, and skulls are creepy. But it had exaggerated features and a red-colored nose, and it was rising from the ground, and it was a preview of the terrors to be found in the first book. So this series was written by author Alvin Schwartz. And it initially featured drawings from Stephen Gemmell. And those are the things I remember the most. They have these creepy pictures. And what's kind of cool, and I haven't seen the new movie yet, so that's one of the things I've been thinking about this week, is that from the pictures, there is a story called The Dream. Oh, my goodness. I went to this website called scaryforkids.com, and it has The Dream. And I didn't realize that when I was looking at the picture of the character in The Dream, it's a girl who is a nightmare. She meets a creepy woman with black hairs and black eyes. So in the, if you see the trailer for this, it's kind of a amorphous blob woman with like no neck, and her face is kind of looks melty. Like she's doesn't have a skeleton hardly under her, but she's just kind of terrifying looking in a weird way. And yet kind of cute to me. I don't know what it is, but and so when I was looking at this website just now to tell you about it, this is a GIF. It's like, you know, they just said it might be pronounced GIF, but I'm going to go with GIF because that's the way I've been brainwashed. And so I'm looking at this picture going, yeah, she's just terrifying. And then all of a sudden she blinks and I go, oh my God. So that's terrifying. So I just want to, I'll do a little bit of a reading from that in just a minute, but what's cool with the Stephen Gemmell art was that the movie, which also has Guillermo del Toro involved, who I love, really, like, you want to get some scary stuff, he's just amazing, beautiful, and terrifying all at the same time. And he has my birthday, too. That's really weird. They used the art as inspiration in the movie. So some of the characters that you see from the drawings look exactly like they do in the books. So it lives up to expectations there. And I thought that was really cool. So 1981, these books started. So throughout the years, it grew. It was from passed down from generation to generation. So let me see. My math brain isn't working right. So it's 2019, right? 2019 minus 1981, 38 years, almost 40 years, right? Okay. So, you know, some of these people weren't even born when these books first came out. I was, but I was actually, like, I didn't remember seeing them too much when I was younger. It was when I was actually in high school, when they, like, the word got out more that they were banned books, that I actually saw them. I went, oh, this isn't that scary. I've always, I love horror. When I was a kid, even in, I think I was in fourth grade, I actually read Firestarter. I was a very advanced reader, and I loved Stephen King, even to this day. He's just so great. Some of the ideas for stories are super weird and fun. And, you know, you get around academics, and they're like, I didn't read that. I didn't read Stephen King. I'm like, you know what? Stephen King's awesome. He's awesome sauce, and I will always love being freaked out. So, yay, Stephen King. So anyway, it would have been my jam, but like I never saw these books until like I was a little bit older, and then it seemed a little bit past my reading level. I mean, I was past it in reading levels anyway. So, but now I kind of appreciate it because I love banned books. I think you need to defend this. Like, if kids want to read it. They love, kids love gross stuff and scary stuff. And if you think you're going to protect people from it forever, especially like it's written at a children's level, it seems like it's actually quite appropriate for the age that it's going at. For it was in children's sections of libraries and at book fairs, children ate it up. They loved it, but parents were terrified of it. So there was an outcry to condemn them. And the appearance of the series on many banned books lists for the last 3 decades has only improved the sales. You know, like if I want to get somebody to read something in my library, even at college level, you just say, that's a banned book. And they're like, ooh, I got to read it now. You know, they may not have any attention, but there's something sexy about a banned book, right? So why is it so bad? And judge for yourself. And I like that. I like letting people judge for themselves anyway. I will say the caveat is if, like, I know people, I have friends who are just, they don't want to watch shows with blood. They don't want to read stuff with blood. So when I know something has blood in it or it's gory, I'm like, it's kind of scary. Just letting you know there's some gore in it. And people might be like, yeah, cool. I love it. But, you know, I think about all the times that I was reading Stephen King books and I was thinking about the first time I read It. And there was a scene where, God, what was it? It was Pennywise was talking to the little girl in it. I can't remember the character's name, through the drain. And it just freaked me out. I threw the book across the room because I was so scared. And to this day, like, I am very cautious around little drains because I always think that, like, no, there's no Pennywise in the drain. Yeah. I read that story and it got into my brain. So clowns are scary, y'all. So strengthening their legacy. So the outcry, there's a new documentary. And so they talk about the 3 decades of banning these books. Children love things that are inappropriate. So this Cody Murick is the director of a documentary now. So this is the thing, your assignment to, like, if you want to know more, it's a documentary called Scary Stories. So this week I'm going to be watching that and learning more too, because I know what I've read and I know about the stories, but I haven't seen the movie and I want to see the documentary before I go see the movie. So I get even more excited. So there's this Cody Merrick had an interview with Inverse. And said Schwartz really loved the fact that his books were being banned. The attention to censorship within schools and libraries was just beginning to take shape around the time of his passing in the early 90s. So the American Library Association really started tracking and making lists of them in the mid-1980s, which was when his books really began to take off. But Alvin loved it and thought it was great publicity. And seriously, nothing like banning a book that makes everybody want to read it. So lots of children love the books, but parents did not. It was kind of gruesome. They're very scary. And a lot of parents might not have liked it because their kids read the books and got freaked out. When I was a kid, I took responsibility. Maybe it's because I was born like an old person or something. But if I watched a scary movie, watched a scary book, I knew that it was my own dang fault. And if I kept doing it, then I couldn't sleep, I was being stupid. So there was some nights that I would sleep with a light on or a light in the closet, just so that way I knew what was going on. I would rarely go and tell my parents, this is so scary. That doesn't mean other kids don't do that, but I always felt like, you know what, I was a stupid one to watch that. I remember watching a Freddy Krueger movie I think it was even in high school when I watched it. And I was just like, oh, I don't want to go to sleep now. What's going to happen? Is Freddy going to get me? And I always, like, I lay down, and if it's something that's bothering me or scaring me, I was like, you know that's not going to happen, right? It's like, it's a story. And, you know, 99% of the time you can, like, talk yourself out of it. It's the scary stuff in the real world that makes you lose a lot of sleep. So not worth it for fiction, Although, doesn't that really light up your brain? Like reading really good, either scary stories, just good stories in general. So it always helped me go to sleep, actually, even scary ones. So some of the other more frequent titles that appear on the list today for banned books are some of my favorites, like Harry Potter. Who hasn't read Harry Potter? His Dark Materials, which they're coming out with a new movie, and those are really pretty good. I always wondered why those were in there. I think it was mostly because they called the little familiars demons, and I think that freaked people out. And then they had the whole thing with children being kidnapped, and it's scary. It is scary, but they're very good stories, and I see why people love them. But I always was puzzled by that one. And this one we have in our library, The Hate U Give, and I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. So Scary Stories was deemed inappropriate for the depiction of violence and negativity. Negativity, that's a really weird thing to ban a book for. But, I'd be banned probably if you had some negativity issues. So in 1993, there's an interview with Chicago Tribune, and a former elementary school teacher named Sandy Vandenberg offered her comments about the material. She said, "If these books were movies, they'd be R-rated because of the graphic violence. There's no moral to them. The bad guys always win. Scary Stories still frequently challenged to this day, and there's always concern over the content." Well, I'm going to say this. And I think they say this in this article too, is that you kind of compare these to like Aesop's Fables, where they basically say, before they turned them into Disney, Aesop's Fables, they're German, and they had freaky things happen, like kids got eaten because they didn't listen to their parents. Or somebody was tortured, the peas under the bed, they turn them into sweet little stories now that are cutesy. And the reason they were so dark was because they wanted to protect the children from the badness in the world. And a little bit of fear was more memorable than giving them just too much sugar. So people today seem to think that children are, I don't want to say, like, they can't handle it. They don't think they can handle it. But yet, I've talked to enough little kids in libraries that they want darker stuff. But their darker stuff is a lot less brutal than anything I could ever handle. I mean there's children level of dark and there's adult level of dark, and I see that in these books that people like to be scared. They like the hook man stories and the stories that we pass on, and it's horror, and you get an audience of horror. People love spooky stories, and it's kind of amazing that this is something that was so feared by parents. So one of the things that they talk about again is the artwork by Gamel, and it was very unsettling, the black and white images. And people, like, to this day, if you may have read the stories and the content kind of faded from your mind, but you see the art and you go, "Oh yeah, I read that book. That was scary." There's a story called Sam's New Pet, and it features a grotesque sewer rat. And the red spot has a portrait of a young woman with spiders crawling out of her cheek. And people are freaked out by spiders, so that one makes it really gross. And Harold has a shot of a scarecrow, which I saw in the trailer. And he looks like he's hanging with a noose around his neck, and his stitched up stomach adds the unnerving feeling you get while looking at him. So there's a reissue for Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark for its 30th anniversary in 2011. HarperCollins replaced the drawings with a new artist called Brett Hellquist, who was an artist for a series of unfortunate events, which is beautiful. And this artist, Brett Helquist, was hired to make the parents' complaints about the books kind of go away, to calm them down, to make it a little bit less scary looking. So the images that kept children up at night were replaced with tamer illustrations. People hated it. And I'm not saying Brett Helquist is a bad artist. He's great. But what people loved about the stories was that freaking morbid art that was with it. And it was scary. It went perfectly with the stories. So people thought it was censorship. The designs were perfect. So separating them, the art and the text, the illustrations, it was stepping on one's childhood, they say in this article. So the Amazon reviews showed that people are super frustrated with these changes. These might be better toned down for your boring children, but if you're hoping to reminisce about the terrors of your childhood, you have to look elsewhere, said one. And then another person said, you'll be missing out on part of what made these books as wonderful in the first place, said another. So there's websites that you can look at the images side by side, and it was hard to be enthusiastic about the difference. There's something beautiful and horrific about the Gemmell drawings. So in 2017, just to let you know, the books were reissued again in a collection with the original art. So they listened. They were worried. And so people who think their kids are going to be terrified, they have the option of the new art. But really, if the kids are reading it anyway, they're probably going to love the gruesomeness of the Gemmell art. So now we fast forward to after 2013. Guillermo del Toro was attached to the project as a writer and a producer. He shared love for the books during press junkets. He said, when I saw the cover of Scary Stories Volume 1, it was astounding. He told Vulture this summer he was so impressed and influenced by the drawings that he purchased 9 of Gemmell's illustrations from the books. So Guillermo del Toro, who, if you ever get a chance to go see his art, he had a traveling show that highlighted it, had costumes and everything too. Just amazing. Del Toro wanted to make sure that the feeling of seeing those creatures in the book came across on the big screen. So this is where I totally think they've nailed it. I mean, I saw the trailer and went, oh my God, there's that lady, the one that scares me with the big black eyes and long hair. She looks just like she does in the book. It's terrifying. So he expresses a concept for bringing this to life. He said, we wanted to emulate with the creatures the black and white feeling of the illustrations in the book. We knew we wanted them drained of color because it makes it scarier. So there's Del Toro and a director, Andre Orvidal. Looks evoking that original artwork for the creature designs in the movie. Audiences can appreciate that banned and censored imagery anew. And longtime fans get to cinematically re-experience monsters that haunted their dreams long ago. Maybe even relive some of their old nightmares. Freaking terrifying. So there was a, so they talk about a little bit more about they're hated by the teachers. Teachers have hated this series too. There was efforts to ban the series from school libraries. The collection of books was in fact one of the most challenged and banned franchises of the 90s. They said that they called them repulsive and disgusting because, okay, I'm just going to be honest with you. There's depiction of cannibalism, murder, and dismemberment. This isn't real innocent stuff, right? But I'm just going to say, not all kids should or even could read that kind of stuff. But I remember being like in fourth grade and reading way scarier things, and it wouldn't have bothered me. But other kids, they get nightmares. They're easily susceptible. And I mean, you kind of got to talk to your kids and know what kind of things they like, what they can handle. And if you see them reading it, you know, instead of just take that out of here, get out of here, have a discussion about it. Like, why are you reading it? What do you like about it? You know, maybe read some of this stuff. Look at it a little bit. You know, and if it really bothers you, talk to your kids and see. See, talk to librarians. See why they added it to a collection. You know, you have a right to disagree. That's the beauty of this country. But to take it away totally, to ban it, is making it so people can't decide for themselves what's right for them, what's right for their own kids. So please at least take under my advisement that I think that it's kind of cool that it exists. And obviously the new series is probably more aiming for adults that grew up reading the series. So I'm not sure I would take a bunch of little kids to it. But I gotta look up. Give me 1 second. I'm going to see if I can figure out what it was rated. That's one thing I didn't look at. Because remember that one teacher said they thought it was going to be R-rated. What is it rated? PG-13, kids. So, not R-rated. And I think that age for that kind of movie, most 13-year-olds can handle it. You're not going to bring little ones into a movie like that, but you're talking preteen and teen. They've seen worse. They've talked worse. But you got to look at maturity of each person as an individual. And some kids can handle it and some can't. So what I think I'm going to do, I'm just going to look through really quick. The adaptation Del Toro bought, there's stars in it, Michael Garza, Austin Abrams, Gabriel Rush, Austin Zager, and Natalie Ganshorn. So the story begins with a group of teenagers discover the haunted home of a tormented woman named Sarah Bellows. Bellows turned her tortured existence into a series of short, scary stories that become horrifying reality for anyone unlucky enough to discover them. So it's a film of creepy, murderous scarecrows and singing decapitated heads holds the same magic and horror as the original book series. The thing that I wanted to mention, though, is despite how creepy it is, they all have morals and lessons to offer children, just like any good Aesop fable would do. So after all, it's created to be family-friendly, haunted house experience for kids to see their beloved horror franchise come to life. Whether or not parents will get on board remains to be seen, but one thing is for sure, scary stories to tell in the dark will terrify kids of all ages, and probably grown-ups too. So, I was looking at, there's a website called Scary for Kids, and it's got scary stories and short stories, so it has some of the ideas from these, and the one I was just looking at was that one with the dream. So this is the one about the woman with the black hair and the black eyes. It's based on a tale recounted by Augustus Hare in his autobiography. This is a version of the story that appeared in Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Now I'm just going to read a little bit of this so you can get a taste of what it is. So that way you can decide for yourself if it's something. And so this is from Scary Stories, scaryforkids.com, and this is The Dream. And it's written by the author, Alvin Schwartz. And it looks, frankly, just like the Stephen Gamel terrifying art. And it has a picture of the art that I'm talking about. So if you look through this page, there's a lot of this here. So anyway, I'm going to read a little bit for you guys. Lexi Morgan had a dream. She was walking up a dark staircase. When she got to the top, she walked into a bedroom. The bedroom carpet was made up of large squares that looked like trapdoors, and each of the windows was fastened shut with big nails that stuck up out of the wood. In her dream, Lexi went to sleep in the bedroom. But during the night, a woman with a pale face, black eyes and long black hair slipped silently into the room. She leaned over the bed and whispered, "This is an evil place. Run away while you still can." Then the black-haired woman grabbed her arm. Lexi Morgan awoke with a scream and lay awake the rest of the night, shivering and shaking with fear. In the morning, she told her landlady that she had decided not to go to Kingston after all. I can't tell you why, she said, but I just can't bring myself to go there. Then why don't you go to Dorset, the landlady said. It's a pretty town. It isn't too far. So Lexi Morgan went to Dorset. Someone told her she could find a room in a house at the top of the hill. It was a pleasant-looking house, and the landlady there, a plump, motherly woman, was as nice as could be. Let's look at the room, she said. I think you'll like it. They walked up a dark, carved staircase, just like the one in Lexi's dream. In these old houses, the staircases are all the same, Lexi thought. But when the landlady opened the door to the bedroom, it was the room in her dream, with the same carpet that looked like trapdoors and the same windows fastened with big nails. This is just a coincidence, Lexi told herself. How do you like it? The landlady asked. I'm not sure, Lexi said. Well, take your time, the landlady said. I'll bring up some tea while you think about it. Lexi sat on the bed, staring at the trapdoors and the big nails. Soon there was a knock on the door. It's the landlady with the tea, she thought. But it wasn't the landlady. It was the woman with pale face and black eyes and long black hair. Lexi Morgan grabbed her things and fled. The end. So, you can tell they're creepy stories. You know, a couple weeks ago we talked about creepypasta and those kind of stories. And some of them are far more terrifying to me than any of these scary stories are. But I think together with the pictures, it can really get in your head. And I can see why people would be a little scared for their kids. But I think it's, if you have kids that are smart and precocious enough that they're interested in it, these aren't as bad as what people make them out to be. Read them for yourself. And if you're worried about it and you know that books have been banned and you're a little worried for your kids, read them first. Most of these take no time to go through, and it's worth it. So that way you know what kind of things your kids are interested in. And I always say, just have conversations with people. So, what do you think about scary story for kids? The scary stories to tell in the dark. You know, I'm looking at some of the art, and it's just freaky. The one with the spiders does definitely freak me out a bit. And, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff about art. And I think the art is actually the thing that bothers me the most. But, you know, because they're black and white, they also, there's something kind of like far away about them. And I like that. So I hope that these inspire you to maybe go to the movie. Definitely look at the documentary. I'm going to look that up really quick for you. I think that's on, is it Amazon Prime? I'm going to look that up. Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark documentary. I think it's on Netflix then. Let me look. Where to watch? There we go. Red Central has a trailer for this too. I might post that to my Facebook page so that way you can see for yourself about the documentary and how to get to it. Let's see. Boy, my internet's going slow. I just want to tell you, I think it's on Netflix. It might be coming soon. I think it's out now though, because I think that it's something that's right there. Explores the banned books. So yeah, it's been out for a while. It says it's on Prime Video, Amazon Prime. So I don't know that it's on the others or not. It's rental. More options. Yeah, it looks like it's on Amazon Prime. It might be something you have to rent. But I'll look around. If I can find a free version, I'll post it on the Facebook too. So and that way you know where to go see it. But I'll definitely post a trailer so you can see the trailer for the documentary as well. Are there other banned books from your past that you're really excited about that changed who you are and you're glad that you read? Share in the Facebook. We can always talk about it. I think that some of these scary stories really, you know, formed who I am now in my own natural sense of being a little bit cautious and wanting to protect my freedom and protect other people's freedom comes from that, because the scary stories are cautionary tales, and cautionary tales build that up inside yourself, that you're not a weak person, that you're not the one that's the big bad wolf is going to jump on the path, you know, because you know there are bad things out there. You don't have to be a dark person that's always worried, but you're smart and you know that there is stuff out there that you have to be careful of. So I think sometimes a little bit of horror is a good thing for people to read and to know about. So it makes you all smarter, and I want you to be smart, and I want you to all be safe. So on that note, let me know if you see the movie, if you like it, or if you're interested, and if you've seen the documentary. I'm going to look up the links and start posting that. But I hope you have a great week, and I hope that if your kids are going back to school or you're going back to school, you have a good beginning of the school. I got a couple weeks yet. I think next week I have to meet up with the rest of the faculty and get ready. And then the week after that, our school starts. So it's coming soon. It's almost here. It comes really fast, doesn't it? But have a great week, and I will see you next Monday. Bye, guys. I'm going to post. I just love my Liberty Librarian ad, so I'm just going to post again just because I think it's so cool to have an ad. Let's see, where did it go? You're like, Heather, what are you doing? Oh, fudge. I'm going to post an ad and then I will get right out of here. Oh, here it is.
Tune in every Monday with your host, Heather Biederman, for the Liberty Librarian. Liberty Librarian, your home for intellectual freedom news and commentary. Every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Central, and 6 p.m. Eastern. All intellectual freedom fighters are always welcome at our home on Freedomizer Radio. Join us.